You're listening to the Community Character Hour. We begin each episode with a newspaper clipping from the past. What have we got today, Hannah?
Well, this one's from the recent past, from the Sandpoint Reader on November 27th, 2024. This is just an excerpt. Based on earlier archaeological findings, the oldest evidence of human occupation in the local area dated to between 6,000 and 7,000 years ago. However, new artifacts uncovered during a recent construction project on U.S. Highway 95 near MacArthur Lake have pushed back that timeline to 10,546 years ago. Where we all live, the archaeology hasn't been as well documented as a lot of other places yet. There's just been hints that there could be an earlier archaeological component, said Jill Wheaton, an archaeologist and member of the Kootenai Tribe of Idaho who led the dig. Traditional Kootenai knowledge talks about geologically a time before, an older time that lines up with geological events. That's why I always thought there could be older things. The article goes on to discuss the paleosol layer Wheaton and her team discovered and how it functioned like a time capsule for any artifacts found within. Their discoveries, which earned the President's Transportation Award from the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Offices, the organization's most prestigious honor, completely change our understanding of ancient history in North Idaho.
Indeed. you picked a recent one here. I guess this is the oldest history that we know of, but it's changing. Our understanding is changing especially right now. It's changing quite a bit of the ancient past in this area. I'm Jack Peterson. I'm joined, as always, by Hannah Combs, Executive Director of the Bonner County Historical Society and Museum, and Heather Upton, Arts and Historic Preservation Planner for the City of Sandpoint. Why did you choose this article, Hannah? Or Heather? Heather chose this one. Who chose this one?
Well, I think it's a very personal moment for me because I live off MacArthur Lake. And I drove by there, and I think anybody that's had to go down 95 has been impacted by that and wondered what's going on there, especially when you saw those pop-up tents and a dig going on. And it gives us a window to what we're going to be talking about today. And I think it's fascinating that every day there's new discoveries that are being made that challenge what we thought of as our history, and we're learning more and more. And it's constantly revealing ourselves in the soils, and to think that that was underneath us all this time. And thank goodness for the Preservation Act of 1966, which is a section within the federal government, which says anytime federal funds are being used, you have to do an assessment, a cultural study, making sure you're not, you know, creating a negative impacts, you know, to the lands. And this is a great example of the power and the positivity that Preservation Act is doing. We've learned so much more about who we are.
It seems lucky that they made such a significant find while working on a highway project.
Well, actually, because modern day roads generally all roads generally follow the path of least resistance through the landscape. So it's not uncommon for modern day roads to be built on older roads that were often built on ancient trails. So it's really great that these archaeological digs are often tied into Department of Transportation projects, because it can be more likely to find culturally significant sites along those old trails.
Makes sense.
It does. Someday we're going to have to do a whole episode on this dig and what they figured out. But that's not what we're talking about today. This dig helps us understand how people lived way back then. How else do we learn about what life was like before written records?
So even if there weren't written records, most ancient civilizations had strong oral history traditions where stories are passed down through generations by verbal storytelling. We actually have one to share today. This story was documented in E.E. Clarke's 1966 book, Indian Legends from the Northern Rockies. It's called The Great Flood in the Kootenai Country.
Okay, so in the days when all the animal people lived on the east side of the lake, they used to cross the water for huckleberries. One day as they were returning, Duck and his wife were swallowed by a great monster named Deep Water Dweller. Duck's brother, Woodpecker, decided to call all the fish together in order to find out where this monster could be found. So he sent Dipper upstream every stream to invite all the fish to the council. He sent Snipe around the lake with the same message. When the fish arrived at the council meeting, Woodpecker explained to them, "I have lost my brother. Deep Water Dweller has swallowed him. You fish must know where this monster lives. Where can I find him?" At that moment, there appeared in the council a very tall person, so tall that if he had stood upright, his head would have touched the sky. He was a person, not an animal. He had been traveling from north to south, stopping at each place to give it a name. Woodpecker asked him to drive the monster out of the water, and so the stranger waited in the lake. He kicked at the Deep Water Dweller, but missed him. The monster fled into the river, up a small creek, and into the very source of the stream under the mountains. After him crawled the tall person. He built a dam at the place where the monster had gone under the mountain. Woodpecker now placed his brother, Sapsucker, beside the dam and told him, "When the monster comes out, tell him that Woodpecker is going to spear him. Then he will stop, and I will come round and kill him." Woodpecker then went to the other side of the mountain and kicked. The monster started to come out. When he reached the dam, Sapsucker became excited and so confused that he called out, "Sapsucker is going to kill you."
The monster broke through the dam, grunting, "Sapsucker, I am not afraid of your spear. I am going to swallow you." Sapsucker turned and ran. Just at that moment, Woodpecker appeared and pierced the monster with his bill. But as the monster had already started to enter the stream below the dam, he was wounded only in a foot. Leaving a trail of blood, he hurried down the stream. Woodpecker sent Beaver ahead to build a dam. When the monster got that far, he could go no further. Woodpecker came up and killed him. He ripped the monster open and released Duck and his wife. Blood, which was really water, began to flow from the monster's wounds. Gradually, it spread over the earth until the people had to flee to the mountains.
Chicken Hawk pulled out one of his spotted tail feathers and stuck it into the ground at the edge of the rising water. "Watch," said Chicken Hawk. "If the water goes above that first stripe, we shall be drowned." The water stopped at the last stripe and then began to go down. The animal people were saved. After the flood was gone, not all the animal people came down to earth. At that time, some of the birds began to live in the mountains, where they live to this day.
There's a lot going on in this story. We've got men, animals, monsters, and it seems to culminate with a dramatic flood.
Yeah. This story likely originates further north in modern-day British Columbia. But the flood myth is something that we see told several times by different Northwest tribes. It's tantalizing to consider whether they might all be connected to the cataclysmic floods that impacted the entire Columbia region in ancient times.
Tantalizing indeed.
Today we're going to be talking about the glacial Lake Missoula and the Ice Age floods that created the Northwest as we know it today and connect us to the landscapes on the coast.
We were lucky to have the chance to talk with a scholar from the Ice Age Floods Institute.
And they have a wonderful resource to help you visualize the events we're about to discuss. If you want to follow along, now would be a good time to go to iafi.org. Under the Resources tab, you can find their interactive map.
And with that, let me pull this up here. We're going to play our conversation with Tony Lewis from the Ice Age Floods Institute. Just one moment. You're listening to the Community Character Hour here on 88.5 KRFY. We're here in the Tiki Room now with Tony Lewis. He's the president of the Corps du Deluge chapter of the Ice Age Floods Institute. Good morning, Tony, or actually good afternoon. We're recording this in advance on the afternoon of Wednesday, January 22nd for our Monday morning radio show. Good afternoon, Tony. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for inviting me. I always love to talk about the Ice Age floods, so this gives me this opportunity. I'm the president. My mother always said I was going to be president, and she didn't know it would just be of a small chapter in the Ice Age floods. But I am I'm president of that. I've been president for probably about 15 years, and I think I'm giving it up this year. And there are 11 chapters.
It's a scoop here.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Big scoop. Mm-hmm. The Ice Age floods. If you haven't heard about it, an Ice Age Flood Institute is a nonprofit that's devoted to the education of the public about natural events, especially the Ice Age floods and how they've impacted our environment and the causes and effects of them. I've been president for, 15 years. It's enough.
Yeah. How did you become involved in this, so heavily involved anyway, in this?
I was hoodwinked. When we moved here, my daughter told me about the Ice Age floods. And so I came to some meetings, and all of a sudden I was asked to be vice president. And I thought, okay, that's fine. Vice president doesn't do anything. But then the president quit. so I've been the president since then.
It wasn't something that you grew up with or anything. Oh, it just became fascinating once you moved here.
Well, I taught at LSU for 29 years, Louisiana State University for 29 years. Mm-hmm. And my field is physical geography and remote sensing, like satellites and stuff. And when we moved out here, that this just seemed like a natural thing to become involved with, because to tell you the truth, I'd never heard of the Ice Age floods. Most people east of the Mississippi probably haven't. But it's really a very exciting, interesting kind of phenomena, and I'm really happy that I got into it. It's kept me busy, I guess, academically, and as I love to give talks, and so it worked out well for me. But it's time.
You mentioned that you hadn't actually heard of it, even though you were a professional academic studying geography, physical geography. Yeah. I certainly hadn't heard of it. I'm just a layman, of course. I think if you grow up here and you go through elementary school and high school, really in this area, you do learn a little bit about it. It's part of the curriculum here locally.
Yeah, definitely.
But I imagine there's lots of people in our listening audience right now who are completely unaware. So give us, I guess, the basics of, if I just say, what were the Ice Age floods? Okay. How do you answer that question?
Well, the Ice Age floods were these catastrophic events that occurred, the ones that we're interested in, occurred at the end of the Wisconsin glaciation. And the dates they keep fluctuating, but probably around 18,000 years ago when this was occurring. And this is the end of the Wisconsin period of glaciation, when there was a massive amount of glacial forming in Canada. In fact, if you look at the map of Canada and how big it is, probably about 95% of Canada was covered with this glacial material. And it moved out of this central part of Canada where it was maybe 10 miles deep, and it pushed down, and as it pushed down on this massive amount of ice, the ice becomes kind of liquefied and moves out, and some of it moved west and then south, and it came to what's called the Purcell Trench, which is a structural valley that goes into Canada. And when it hit the Purcell Trench, this was really just an opening for this ice to move south. And it moved south through the Purcell Trench, and Sandpoint is at the point, is at the end of the Purcell Trench. And the ice moved down over Sandpoint as it was pushing and moving there, and moved out over Segal Peninsula and over to the Monarchs, and hit the Monarchs, and then it started breaking up into sublobes. The Purcell Trench was the ice that came through there. They call it the Purcell Trench ice lobe. And when it came down and started banging up against the Monarchs, it started breaking up into sublobes. And one of the sublobes went up the Clark Fork. Another went down the area we call Lake Pend'Oreille now. One went up went down Highway 95, and another one went back up where the Pend'Oreille River is. And they blocked the flow of the water coming out of the Clark Fork. And over time, this ice dam, which was, it depends upon who you're talking to, but could have been 5,000 feet thick and 20 feet wide, and I'm sorry, 20 feet, yeah, 20 miles wide, and 30-some miles long. And where this dam broke is still in question. And if I can tell a little story now. When I first moved here and I gave an interview to the local paper, one of the things I was asked was about where the ice dam broke. And I live on Segal Peninsula, and I was talking about, you know, it breaking there. And when I read this interview, I knew this wasn't going to go very well with people. And on Monday, sure enough, I get this phone call from this elderly lady over in Clark Fork. And she proceeds to ask me where I lived and and did I know where the dam really broke. and we became very good friends later on, but she pretty much told me after talking to her for about 10 minutes, I said, "Well, you probably know more about the floods than I do." And she said, "Yes, I do." I knew I liked her then. So, but she has died. She's passed, and she was really an interesting lady who lived over right on the Clark Fork.
Yeah. Well, what you're talking about has really changed my whole understanding of the dam itself, because I think until we started having this conversation, I always imagined it as sort of like a castle wall, you know, like maybe the dam was 20 feet thick, but it just stretched in a line across the mouth of the Clark Fork River. And what you're describing is so much more complex than that.
Yeah, it is very complex. And how many times we had these floods, and how many times this thing advanced and retreated and all like that, it's still up in the air, as I think, as you know, that, I mean, some people say there's up to 100 floods. There were up to 100 floods. And then on the other hand, a couple of people over in Spokane Valley say there was one. And so I think there was 50.
Okay.
Split the difference?
Split the difference. I'm not sure how many floods there were, but there's evidence of how many floods there were. And they use what, here's a nice term, called rhythmites. It's a feature. And these features called rhythmites are features that form in still water that's backed up during flood times, and they form these different layers. And people go into them, and they count these layers, and they figure that each one of them represents a flood. And that's how people come up with these numbers. And some places, there seems to be, you know, 100 floods in some places. There's 50. And,
mm-hmm. Interesting.
And the people over in Spokane Valley, they're geologists, and they've studied this a lot. And they probably have 10, 15 years of field work in Spokane Valley. And they're the ones that come up with one. But it, but there's a little caveat to that. They say there's one major flood. And that doesn't mean there weren't a lot of smaller ones.
But so it this ice dam formed basically in Lake Pond, where Lake Pondere is now, at that more or less at that point where the Clark Fork River drained into Lake Pondere. And then and was huge, not just a wall, but a, covered the lake more or less. And behind the dam, the water of the Clark Fork River started to fill up and created Glacial Lake Missoula.
Correct.
Which described that body of water for us.
Oh, yeah. Well, Glacial Lake Missoula is a gigantic lake that was formed behind this ice plug. And you know, it went all the way back up to Missoula, where it was over 1,000 feet deep. And if you go to Missoula and Sentinel Mountain, if you look at it, there's these little lines that are parallel. They look like contour lines. They are really lines marking the level of the lake level of Glacial Lake Missoula.
And how, so I'm so curious, because I've been over there and I've seen multiple of these lines kind of going up the hills. How long would it take those lines to form?
Yeah, you know, it's a tough one. I don't know. They call them strand lines, and there are features that occur when you have a certain still level of a lake or something, and it's and the waves are crashing up against the shore, and they develop a little shoreline. They call them strand lines, but they are shorelines, and it's accumulation of a of material that's a certain size, and that depends upon the power of these waves and how long they go. So it filled back up there and would periodically break. This dam would periodically break, and the amount of water that was in there, I say 500 cubic miles of water, enough that would fill two of the Great Lakes. And they figured when it broke, the dam broke, it broke catastrophically, and this puddle of water behind this ice dam would empty in 2 or 3 days. And travel at 60 miles an hour. And it's not what you think of as the water that you might see in Spokane River. This was a slurry of trees and dirt and rocks and boulders and icebergs that were carrying gigantic rocks that weighed tons and tons. And this this was a very catastrophic event.
So this is why when you're driving through eastern Washington, sometimes you just see these giant rocks in the middle of
you see them all over here too. If you walk around here, if you go down to City Beach and you see those rocks, those mini boulders there, that if they look white, if they're light colored and speckled, they're not from here. They're all probably from Canada or Montana. They're what are called erratics, and they were sometimes carried in the flow of the water, but it's pretty tough for floods even that magnitude to carry boulders that are the size of what was carried. And the thought is that they were floated in icebergs, and so the icebergs had to be pretty big to float these things. But that's how they figured that they got so far. And they got, you know, you have gigantic glacial erratics in the Willamette Valley. And so they floated all the way that far.
Wow. Yeah, we were talking about that. I'm from the Willamette Valley area. And
me too.
Oh, fabulous.
Barbara was born in Corvallis.
Okay, I'm from McMinnville.
Yeah.
The soil is so rich.
Yeah, well.
Did we take all the soil from up here?
You didn't take it from here. You took it from Canada.
Okay,
I mean, this whole area owes so much to Canada.
Okay.
And the soils.
That good old Canadian soil.
All the wineries in the Willamette Valley are there because of these. That formed a big lake all the way back to Eugene. So these are lake deposits in the Willamette Valley that are farmed so intensively.
And that's probably why we both still feel at home being here up north. Because it's the same terrain, right?
Yes,
that was carried through.
Yeah, the same
terrain.
Mm. Yeah.
That's fun.
The effects are huge and are felt across at least three states here. But I guess we're going to focus mostly on the effects of these floods locally, just for the sake of time. Before the very first flood, what did this area look like compared to now? How was it different before that first flood happened?
I guess this is going to
call for some speculation, maybe. But what's the best guess?
Well, it was mountainous and rocky. I mean, that mm-hmm. is the formation of the mountains and the chains here are a lot more distant and. At that point in time, before any of the floods and before the lobes came down and the glacial lobes came down, there was a structural valley here that is now occupied by Lake Ponderay.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't formed by the glacier, but it was deepened by the glacier.
Uh-huh.
Mm, that was one of my questions is... If mm-hmm. the flood had, or the glacier had the power to move these big rocks, did it also have the power to carve the lake?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. But again, the structural valley was already there.
Huh.
The reason they know why it was also modified by the glacier is that, there's a naval station. And they do mm-hmm. acoustical research.
Mm-hmm.
Roy Breckenridge, who used to be a state geologist, he got a hold of some of their tracings, sonar.
Mm.
And if you look at these cross-section of the sonar, you can see that it's a classic U-shaped valley, which means it's glaciated. If it's a stream valley, it's usually V-shaped.
Mm. Interesting.
And, you know, but... Everything's complicated. It's not, these are textbook things.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look and you see, and there's a diagram of this Gene Kiefer's and, forgotten the guy's name. The book that's out that's called, that's the, you can buy it at Keoki.
I'll find it. Are you saying on the trail of the Ice Age floods?
Yeah. On the trail of the Ice Age floods, the northern
mm-hmm.
reaches.
Mm-hmm.
And why I can't think of the other guy's name, I don't know. But anyway.
Bruce Bjornstad is who he's talking about here.
Drones now. Mm-hmm. And he's put out really some beautiful coffee table books of these some of the shots that he's taken. And... they have this cross-section diagram in their book of this sonar, and it's really U-shaped, and so you know that it was cut by that. So the lake is 1,000 feet deep, and then sediments go to the bottom of the lake, and you can go another 1,000 feet, and that's where this glacier was cutting, and it cut. They say all the way down to 600 feet below sea level.
Wow.
That's so interesting. Were there minerals that are more native to other places that were dropped in our area that we wouldn't have had if, like, specific?
Well, I think it's more of minerals, yes. But, I mean, we have a lot of mountains around here.
Mm-hmm.
And we do have some mountains that have some granites. Most of them are these metasediments that we have that are found over near Hope and all. But the minerals, well, you wouldn't have had the aquifer.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay. I mean, there would have been, what you're really dealing with is soft sediments, unconsolidated sediments is what they brought to this place, along with these gigantic erratic boulders.
Gotcha.
Mm. But they wouldn't have contributed much to, mm-hmm. I mean, the soils are here because of the floods.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was talking before, I mean, Sandpoint wouldn't be here. There would be no Sandpoint.
Mm-hmm.
There would be no Coeur d'Alene. There would be no Spokane without these Ice Age floods.
We have a lot to think.
Yes, the entire aquifer, the Spokane Valley, Rathdrum Aquifer, are all flood deposits, and they are the aquifer that feeds all the whole Spokane Valley, not Sandpoint, but Spokane Valley. They're there because of this aquifer. All the lakes that you see, Lake Coeur d'Alene, Spirit Lake, these are all lakes that are formed because of these deposits from the floods block the drainage basin, and the water formed behind it and formed Spirit Lake and Hayden and Lake Coeur d'Alene and all those lakes. And so that's all the recreation, all the fishing.
So Ice Age floods created tourism. We figured it out.
That was the key.
It sure did. And it also supports all the industry and the water, the public use of water is all because of this aquifer.
Yeah.
Amidst Ice Age floods.
Okay. Well, that's what it brought. What did it take away? When these floods came through, what did we lose anything? Did we lose, were there minerals that would have been here or geological features that would have been here that were?
No, I would think not. I think it obviously was eroding and it cleared out a lot of Montana as it pushed through. And once it hit, down at Farragut State Park where it emptied and you have this blowout there that, you know, it was still large and it was carrying a lot of material, trees and rocks and boulders. But I think we were really lucky. Mainly it was deposition. I don't see probably more result from the glacier, you know, carving a little bit out of Lake Pendere, drainage area. But I don't see much. It's mainly deposition.
Yeah. I guess two-part question. Oh, one-part question. When was this? What is the rough time period that we're talking about for these
I guess it depends upon who you read, and it's changing all the time.
I read Tony Lewis.
Yeah. Tony Lewis doesn't know.
Oh, okay.
Tony Lewis knows what they're telling him.
Yeah.
But it's 14,000
years ago.
14,000 years ago, yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But they keep pushing some of these things back, and people want to know if there were indigenous people here.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you if they were, they made it to the Pacific Ocean.
Oh.
There was nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, this was a catastrophic flood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If they were here, they were probably living close to the water source.
Yeah.
And anything below the level of these floods was washed out.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And when I first came here, I think, 15, 16 years ago, people were saying, no, there's no way there were people here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Indigenous. Now it's changing.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
There's more and more evidence that it's pushing it back to around the time of these floods, the last floods, perhaps, 14,000 years ago.
Right.
So it's getting there.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
With the Would the flora and fauna at that time have been similar to what we see today, or would it have been substantially different?
Yeah, I don't think it would have been really major. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure that some of the zones moved back and forth, but you know, I don't think it was. That's not my field,
yeah.
But I don't think it was major amounts. Mm-hmm. I mean, it wasn't a tropical area, and sure. Then all of a sudden, it was probably, you know, northern forest,
forested.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would think.
Yeah.
And what else? Let's see.
The lake, the glacial lake Missoula, the temporary lake that formed. Was that, I guess, it formed and then it didn't last for very long. So not long enough for, like, fish to develop there, or a great number of, a great ecosystem of the lake to develop, because it was constantly emptying out every 50, 60 years or whatever. Is that, I guess, I'm just guessing. I'm not a geologist. Is that, do I have the right picture there, you think?
Sounds okay to me.
Okay.
Ask a marine biologist.
A
freshwater biologist. That sounds logical.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if we were having these things every 50 years, as a lot of people propose, then yeah, that's. I don't think it's going to give it much time to fill up with a nice, a diverse amount of water.
Yeah.
Hmm. It is amazing listening to you speak to think of how many people from how many different fields of knowledge have contributed to our understanding of this event or events.
Oh, yeah. That's really obvious when you go to some of the meetings of the Ice Age floods. And in fact, if you go online right now, there is a meeting coming up in May, the annual meeting, And it is a pretty diverse group. I mean, it's mainly geologists, but there's a lot of other people, you know, like myself. I look at things differently than a geologist does. You know, as I said, I'm interested in shapes and patterns and how they come to be, form and process. They kind of look, if you think of a difference between a geographer and a geologist, a geologist moves his head up and down, and a geographer moves it sideways. So we look at landscapes, and they look at cross sections. And then you have a lot of people, you know, looking at the biology a lot of different people.
Yeah. What a rich result of information you all get with all of the experts in the room.
Yeah, you know, if you haven't been to the Ice Age Flood Institute webpage, you really need to go there. It is really packed full of information and field trips and the up-to-date stuff that's going on. And that is at iafi.org.
Mm-hmm. Simple as that.
Yeah, Ice Age Flood Institute.
So there are so many trips I would love to take all over eastern Washington to see the scablands and some of these lands that were sculpted by the floods. But if you could recommend one site in Bonner County you could observe some aspect of what the floods created, what would you recommend?
Well, our chapter has a brochure that we hand out. If you ever come to any of my talks, then it's called Our Catastrophic Floodscape. And it's a guide to the incredible Ice Age floods in northern Idaho. And this brochure, if you open up, of course, the classic place here is the dam. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that's really what... Our chapter is here because of the dam, the ice age, the ice dam in Clark Fork. And that's really a nice place to go. And if you go highway going to over to Hope, and there's a nice turn off there that has geologic overlook, and there's at least two plaques that are up there, and if you stand there and look south, you're looking right at the Monarchs, where this sublobe crashed up against it and split into going up the Clark Fork and down where the Lake Pend'Oreille is now.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really I think the heart of where the plug was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's, and you, I mean, if you look across, you see how steep that face is. I mean, you can just picture this grinding of this ice coming down the Purcell Trench and straight on hitting that straight up and just grinding into it and making this really, really steep, deep place. If you have a sonar on your boat, go over there and look at the depths that are right off of that face. Mm-hmm. It really drops off.
That's where we do all of our fishing.
That's where you do your fishing, yeah. So it's 1,000 feet deep, 900.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's pretty incredible.
Yeah, yeah, it's really.
It's transformative when you're over there.
It is.
I feel that way. It's kind of a.
It makes you feel small.
Right?
You know, you go up against that and look at how big this was and think of, you know, what was happening here during these times of the ice age and the advance and retreat of the glacier.
And I think that's the thing that's interesting is everyone can appreciate that. And everyone, like, you can't drive by that giant boulder, like Hannah was saying, and not go, how did that get right there? Like, it's just so awe-inspiring and still evident today that something really significant happened in this area to make it so unique.
Yeah, there's a place over near Twin Lakes on the highway there that's in the book and in the Trails of the Ice Age Floods, Northern Reaches, and it gives you the mile marker where it is, and this thing is just gigantic. I mean, it looks like a house.
Wow.
It's the size of a small house, and to think that was carried by these, you know, I'm sure it was carried in an iceberg,
mm-hmm.
you know, a floating iceberg. It floated there, but it's amazing that you had such large pieces going. And also in the Willamette Valley, there's some, there's a gigantic erratic there, and also there's a meteorite that.
Mm, that's right.
The famous meteorite was also floated in there on an iceberg.
Oh, I had no idea. That's incredible. So,
and there's a winery right there.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah. There's a great winery.
Dual
right
purpose.
There. Yes, exactly. You can walk up and see this erratic and
with a glass of amazing wine.
Yeah. Well, okay. We mentioned already the website, iafi.org. Tony Lewis, do you have any particular dates of either talks or anything or ways, any particular times that people can come out and see
now I don't have any. I was thinking of setting one up, though, again at the library. I've given talks there. I just gave one about a month ago, I guess, at the Elks.
Ah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Elks annual meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And I've given talks at schools around here. I mean, and I do give talks, and I was kind of amazed when I was given a talk at the Elks. They asked me how much I charge. Well, I don't charge anything. Maybe that's what I'm worth.
So generous of you.
So I'm. If people are interested in a talk, I'm probably interested in giving it.
Okay.
Excellent.
Good. Have you over for dinner and you could entertain them. Okay. The family. But Tony, thank you for
your
being so generous with your time here.
Thank you.
Yeah, I don't, did we miss anything? Hannah, Heather, did any big questions for Tony before we shut these mics off?
He's certainly more captivating than my geology 101 in college. thank you for being here.
This is an easy topic to be.
It's quite eye-opening. Yeah. We appreciate you.
Thanks.
Cratch on the levee, mama, water's gonna overflow. Swamp's gonna rise and no boat's gonna roll. You can train on down to Williams Point, you can bust your feet, you can rock this joint, but oh, mama, you're gonna miss your best friend now.
Bob Dylan, Down in the Flood. You're listening to the Community Character Hour. We're talking Ice Age floods here, and I'm Jack Peterson back on KRFY with Hannah Combs and Heather Upton. That was our conversation with Tony Lewis just before that from the Ice Age Floods Institute, president of the Corps du Déluge chapter.
It was so wonderful that he joined us. And when we think about community character, of course, it's celebrating what's unique about Sandpoint, but it's also about the people, right? And I love that we're starting off this new year with Gus.
Yeah, a community character of our own.
Right.
This was the first time that we were in the studio with a fourth person on the microphone, but I thought it went very nicely.
Yeah, it's nice to have the expertise in the room.
Definitely. Yeah.
That was a very interesting story. I don't know. We don't have that much time and we got more to talk about, but any big surprises from our talk with Tony Lewis? Was there anything you guys didn't already know?
Just about everything.
Yeah. I can't believe I didn't think of it before, but of course the boulders weren't just pushed by the water. They were trapped, most likely, they were trapped in icebergs.
Yeah.
And then just floated and landed. Mm-hmm. It makes so much sense once you think about it. But first, you know, I had not considered that before, that these were, locked in ice and moving that way.
The soil erosions making the basins so we have all of the lakes, that the soil buildup is the cause of that, and that all the good topsoil went to the Willamette Valley. I thought was really interesting, too. From British Columbia.
Yeah. I think even though we're unsure if there were any humans in this part of the country at that time, I always think about the floods as if I'm, you know, that one lucky person who's on top of a mountain when the floods are coming through. And I remember chatting with Tony just a little bit about what would the noise of it have been like? Like, what's the equivalent of how many train horns would you be listening to at that one time? I think he said it was a thundering noise that you would have heard long, long, long before the flood actually got to you.
Probably deafening.
Yeah. Mm. When it's actually going past. Crazy. Yeah, to think about that. To hear it before it comes to you and wonder, what is that sound growing nearer and nearer?
Terrifying.
But I think he said you could probably hear it for like hours before. Even this traveling at 60 miles an hour, you could still hear it long before it got to you. Very interesting. Let's see. After we turned off the mics, there were a couple of other points that we were just chatting with him after he stepped away from the studio. Let's see. We talked a little bit about the, I think he said, we asked, you asked, I think, if the, were there any other comparable floods? The Bonneville flood is probably the second largest flood, but it only happened once.
Yeah. Yeah. And he said, this was probably the most dynamic short-term flash flood in global history.
That's incredible.
Yeah. To think that it happened right here.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the Clark Fork area being like the most important part of that flood, too.
The epicenter of the drama. Yeah.
Yeah.
We're so special.
He pointed out that, there would have been something here because the valley, the deep valley would have been there, but there would not have been a lake without it. I mean, it was. Mm-hmm. It would have been a trickle or a stream, a seasonal stream or something like that, where Lake Bonneré is now.
And like Heather said, it was all of the soil that got pushed out of that area that wound up you know, laying from kind of Bayview to the Rathdrum area, this just huge mound of earth that effectively dammed our lake and made it possible for it to fill with water.
So thank you, Flood for Tourism. Is that kind of what we're...
Yeah, we gave credit to so many people last year, right? But it was the flood all along.
Yeah. So is that the whole story of the Ice Age floods, as we understand it?
Such a huge topic. So we've dipped our toes into the story of the floods themselves, but there's a story that I find equally fascinating about how the flood hypothesis came about. How did we learn that this happened?
Tony said it's unclear, let's see, whether any humans were in the Northwest at the time the floods were happening. And then he kind of made a little gruesome remark that if they were, they weren't, you know, they ended up in the ocean when it did happen. Yeah.
And even though there are flood myths and stories like the one we shared, there's no way to know if they refer to the Ice Age floods or smaller floods that came later.
Well, if that's the case, who determined what happened? How did we find out about these Ice Age floods?
Yeah, this part of the story unfolds in the 1920s with a young geology professor named J. Harlan Bretz. Bretz spent 7 consecutive summers with his graduate students studying unusual rock formations throughout eastern Washington. During their second summer, the mathematics of what they were seeing continued to make no sense to him.
It was obvious that the rocks were shaped by erosion, but of a scale and force that seemed impossible in the desert landscape that surrounded him.
Bretz's earlier work explored Ice Age glacial movements in the Puget Sound area. By the early 20th century, this was a popular topic of study, but his new observations were suggesting something much more radical.
Well, in several papers during this period, Bretz, hypothesized that the erosion in eastern Washington could only have resulted from a cataclysmic water flows suggestive of a massive flood.
He was immediately discredited, in part because such an event of such magnitude was just hard to fathom for people, but also because it implied the possibility of a biblical flood, which scientists of the day rejected. Bretz's work was also brought into question simply because few people were familiar with the landscapes he was describing, and because the Ivy League scientists who dominated the geology field at the time didn't respect him as just a guy from Washington State.
So tough. Despite ongoing attacks from his peers, he continued his research for over 30 years. That's definitely passion-led. NASA satellite imagery collected in the 1960s helped provide visual evidence of the flood paths he'd been studying.
Today, his theories are generally accepted, though there are still many more questions than answers when it comes to the Ice Age floods. Bretz once wrote of the landscape, "The scablands are wounds only partially healed, great wounds in the epidermis of soil with which nature protects the underlying rock." I imagine the wounds he describes were personal in some sense, too, but hopefully not as deep.
Oh, brilliant. And it would have been amazing watching him in that moment when he was right.
Yeah, and I loved that, like, this was the space age in the 60s, and finally they were getting photographic evidence at the scale that he could use to prove his theory. That he wasn't, because he had the math and he had all the equations and like little pieces of it that he was trying to piece together. But that was the moment where it's like, no, look, you can see it on the face of the earth.
It's hard being a pioneer.
Bretz was it started in the 20s, but he did live to see, to see his theory accepted.
He did.
Overall. Mm-hmm. Well, that's at least a sort of a happy ending.
Yeah.
We are desperately short on time here, as always. Let's talk a little bit about what's going on at our respective organizations. Heather, what's going on in the city of Sandpoint?
Well, it's kind of fun with the new year. We're doing a lot of strategic planning and revealing new projects and wrapping up others. We have this really fun new public art program that we're going to be putting out. It's called the Big Belly Monster Art Program.
Okay.
Yeah. So it will be a competition for children 4 to 12. And we're looking for the most fabulous monsters to wrap two of our big bellies downtown. So this will be an art call, a competition, and there'll be a stipend involved too.
Hey.
So there'll be more details to come.
This is the trash can.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And if the mouth will have to open.
Yeah.
It'll be an interactive monster. So just a really unique way to highlight, you know, kids' artwork and remind people to where their trash goes to. And then we did a really successful art residential call with the museum, just trying to find out more about our residential history. We got some really fun new information on our historic homes. And so we're looking to include that in the update and wrap up of our walking tour brochure.
Cool. The paint the plows thing.
Super fun,
super cool. And the plows have just been sitting in the garage all the whole winter.
I know. Yeah. I keep talking to the streets team, and they're like, yeah, you may not have to repaint them next year.
No, yeah, can they just take them out every once in a while and just do a parade? Yeah. Anyway, who knows?
Sometimes 88.5 KRFY.
Pondere. Sometimes we get a dump in February. Okay, real quick then, Hannah, the museum.
On February 1st, that's a Saturday, we are having free first Saturday at the museum. Admission is free. We're open from 10 until 2 o'clock on February 1st. We also have hands-on history, which is our new hands-on kids activities. I know this month it's going to have something to do with Valentine's, so it'll be kind of a fun throwback. And then on Sunday, February 23rd, immediately following the canine keg pull as a part of Winter Carnival, we are partnering with Panada to present a showing of the film they made for Sandpoint Centennial. So it's called Sandpoint at the North End of the Longbridge. It was made by world-renowned cinematographer Eric Darstead, and it talks about the history of Sandpoint from the Ice Age floods all the way up until 2007. So we're excited to be able to show that and hope lots of people come over after the keg pull to see it.
Awesome. Yeah, love that. Love that winter carnival. Here it comes. We are going to go now, I suppose, to Bird Note. Thanks for talking about the Ice Age floods this morning.
Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Heather Upton is the Arts and Historic Preservation Planner for the City of Sandpoint. Hannah Combs is the Executive Director of the Bonner County Historical Society and Museum. I'm Jack Peterson, and we're going, you're listening to 88.5 KRFY Pondere. This is Panhandle Community Radio.